I am fired up.
I'm on fire right now, Jeff Merrick.
You just came off an appearance on Tim
and Sid. You caught me at the wrong time. You caught me at the wrong time, brother.
So, okay, so let's rewind here about, it's 2 minutes after 2 Eastern, so let's rewind about 20 minutes. What happened in the last 20 minutes in your life?
20 minutes ago.
I went on Tim and Sid, as I often do, and we got into a conversation about the Florida Panthers and their attendance, and I said the same thing I wrote about on Puck Daddy, which is the factors behind the crowd that they had the other night for Ottawa and everything else, and then we got into a spirited conversation about Canadian entitlement.
In what way?
Well, in the sense that they believe any franchise in the United States that struggles to build a fan base or sometimes has to give away tickets or may not sell out every game is somehow unworthy of a team. And that those teams should obviously be transferred north of the border because that's where all of the hockey should happen in the National Hockey League.
The first thing I always come back with when I hear arguments like that is... If the NHL is in the job of creating new fans, how many new fans do you create if you move another team to Canada? The answer is less than one.
Right.
Zero.
I know. Here's the two things that bother me right now. I'm tired of the soft U.S. market roulette that Canadian journalists do. Every couple of years, we pick a new one. We're going to focus
Hang on.
What?
It's not as if the soft U.S. markets don't give Canadian. And listen, I'm not defending it. I'm just saying it's not as if they don't hand them ammunition.
Right. But is there a but there or no?
No.
Is there a but?
It's not as if there isn't, you know, sufficient ammunition for what may be a lazy story. And I get that. But it isn't as if that is without some basis in fact. And now it might just be an eyeball test. Oh, look, no one's going to see the Panthers in the Ottawa Senators. Look, no one's going, oh, what a farce, move this team to Quebec City ASAP. The NHL is leaving money on the table. But it's not as if, you know, writers and broadcasters don't have something to arm themselves with or aren't armed themselves with the fact of the reality of low attendance. But the folly of it is that, and this is what I took great delight in, people from Chicago blasting Florida Panthers fans for not going to games.
Yeah.
Wasn't that long ago we were talking about Dollar Bill Wirtz and not having the home games on television and what that did at the turnstiles.
Yeah.
I mean, that was less than a decade ago. That I found endlessly funny.
Right, and you bring up a good point. And there's two points I want to make here about this stuff. And we'll jump into this one first because you've just sort of led us there. When markets struggle and they're, you know, strong markets like Chicago, Chicago's a great hockey town, as we've seen. When markets struggle, the reaction from the teams can be what? To let it struggle, to let the fans not come, to keep the seats empty, to leave all that money on the table, or to improve. Detroit improved back when they drew flies in the 1980s. St. Louis improved
if you want to go Detroit, I remember the Red Wings having to give away a car every game to get people into the building. I remember the Detroit Red Wings.
Right.
Not like the Ilitch family, not having enough money to properly pay head coach Brad Park his salary, so instead they gave him two Little Caesars franchises.
Right. You're saying that they were in the shit, and then they got better. Penguins, before Sidney Crosby arrived, had their season ticket base down to roughly 8,000, Chicago improved when their attendance eroded. The St. Louis Blues improved when their attendance eroded. The Boston Bruins' attendance hit rock bottom, and then they improve. Now, you're going to say it's cyclical, but I'm sorry. There's pressure to improve your team,
There's pressure to improve markets. There's pressure to improve teams in Canada as well.
Well, from where?
Trust me.
What?
From where?
What dollar is leaving the Toronto Maple Leafs for them not having won since the moon landing? What dollar is leaving them?
Do you understand?
Where's it going?
Let me know when you're done saying blah, 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 and then I'll talk. Just let me know when you're done.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, you really mean it. Okay. Are you familiar with what Are you familiar with what live gates are for playoffs at the Air Canada Center?
I'm sure they're amazingly big, yes.
Ridiculously big. That's where the pressure comes from. And that's what ultimately, and people that just want to bash John Ferguson don't like to hear this, but that's what eventually was the undoing of John Ferguson, who would submit two budgets every year, one that accounted for playoff revenue to the board and one that didn't, one that was a rebuild and one that accounted for some playoff revenue. Which one do you think got approved every single time? There is that kind of pressure. So what did that mean? Jettison draft picks, jettison young players in order to get some playoff revenue ASAP. That's the pressure.
Have the Maple Leafs ever lost money?
No. I think when Conn Smythe built Maple Leaf Gardens, actually, you know what? He didn't actually pay. It's a funny story, too, because he didn't actually pay a lot of the workers. They ended up getting more money because they all got shares in the Maple Leafs and Maple Leaf Gardens. They ended up making gobs of money, but they built that building during the recession for essentially pennies and nickels. But the guys all ended up making their money somewhere down there. But have they lost money? Of course not. No, they haven't.
There is never any desperation in Toronto or Edmonton to improve their franchises. The Edmonton Oilers are a goddamn disgrace right now. They're a disgrace. And where is the pressure to dramatically improve that team? It's not coming. The fans are bitching and they're moaning. And the journalists are all like, you should do something important. But no one is staying home. Buying a jersey. It's better to be in a market where the fans don't show up than have a Canadian market that sells out every night and never puts any pressure on management to dramatically improve the product. That's a fact.
Let me ask you a question then. Let's say Oilers fans stop showing up tomorrow. Okay, so at the end of this road trip for the Oilers, let's say the Oilers come back to Rexall and nobody goes to the games.
Mm-hmm.
How does Craig McTavish behave differently? Oh, he goes and signs some free agents? He's been trying to sign free agents. He goes and tries to make some big trades? He's been trying to make big trades. Tell me what Craig McTavish does differently if people stop going.
Well, I think he would probably blow up the roster, first of all, and trade some of those kids.
Okay,
instead of sitting back and letting them incubate and knowing that the arena is going to be sold out no matter what he does. But I think you bring up another.
You don't think he's entertained offers for Hopkins and Jordan Eberle?
I think he'd be more apt to pull the trigger. But you bring up another interesting point, which is that we've not seen a Canadian team win the Cup since 1993.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why is that?
I don't know. Well, first of all, there are more American markets.
Okay.
I think that there is a reluctance for a lot of Canadian players to sign with Canadian teams because, despite your claim to the contrary, there's a lot of pressure playing in a Canadian market.
Yeah, and from the media, right? Not from necessarily
from
the fans,
media.
That's
from
right.
From the fans, there is pressure everywhere. I mean, it must
they don't
be
ever have
nice.
To see an empty seat. I mean, there's
it
always
must
people
be
after
nice.
The game to sign autographs because there's never an empty seat.
That's fine, but you're going to go through lulls, and, you know, when you're trying to have breakfast with your family and everyone's, you know, from two tables across bitching at you about the power play, it can kind of get on your nerves.
Well, I mean, honestly, that's on Tim Hortons to make a bigger restaurant.
I tuned out after the possessive apostrophe vanished, okay? As soon as the pictures came down of the defenseman, I tuned out at Tim Hortons.
They're very small. You can hear every conversation in that place.
Sorry. That is an interesting question, then. It's one that people do, and there is no one answer. Why hasn't a Canadian team won since 1993?
Basically, you're saying that the teams can't attract free agents because the free agents don't want to play there because of the pressure playing in Canadian markets, no matter how much money they throw at them. And then the money becomes an issue because sometimes it's more favorable to play in U.S. markets that don't have tax dollars, for example, than it is to play in Canada. And my question to you is, given those factors and given the fact that we have not seen a Stanley Cup champion in Canada since 1993, why should we have more Canadian franchises?
Oh, so you only put franchises in places that win Stanley Cups? The whole idea, first of all, the idea of another Canadian franchise coming in has nothing to do with relocation, has everything to do with expansion. Do you think I was talking to someone about this at the gym today who said flippantly to me, oh man, Florida's got to move to Quebec. And I'm like, do you think for one second the Board of Governors is going to look at $300 million of expansion money and say, nah, let's just put the Cats there instead? Do you think for a second that's going to happen?
No, and it's like, one of the reasons why they've... It's one
Florida's
of the reasons
going
why,
to Quebec. Not a chance.
And it's one of the reasons why Bettman keeps on finding people to take these markets off people's hands. Take these teams off people's hands. It's because they don't want to have to relocate them and give up all that expansion money. We know that. Mm. But here's the to go back to my original point. It was Carolina for a while. Then it was Nashville. Nashville was going to Hamilton. Okay? Then it was Columbus. Oh, Columbus ain't a hockey market. They can't draw flies. Then it was Arizona and Phoenix because they went into bankruptcy court and Buff Silly tried to steal them and it didn't work out and then they can't still draw fans. But then now they have ownership and everybody's like, ah, phooey, foiled again. Now it's Florida. Look at those empty seats in Florida, says Bruce Garriock and Gord Miller and all those people tweeting pictures. Look at all these empty seats, my Canadian followers. Get your boners up, boys. Here comes the relocation of the Panthers to Quebec City. It's a new bell of the relocation ball every few years. And here's the beauty of it, Merrick. You know what happened today? Guess what was reported today by Sportsnet's own John Shannon?
But, oh, the All-Star Game's going to Nashville.
To Nashville, Tennessee. The place that didn't deserve a friggin' team a scant few years ago is getting the All-Star Game. Why? Oh, this is an amazing thing. They started winning. And building stars and building a fan base. And now Columbus is winning and they're building a fan base and they're putting fannies in seats. My God, what a concept. A team that doesn't suck ass from 2000 to now actually can build a fan base with successful seasons and competitive teams. What an amazing concept. Perhaps the people in Florida will come see the games if their team wasn't an abject embarrassment for more than a decade. What an amazing thought.
This gets to something I've always wondered about, because in sports, there have to be winners and losers. The idea of a tie is gone. The Canadian score is gone, okay? The Americans have wiped out the Canadian score. That is gone. So there has to be a winner, and there has to be a loser.
I was at that Ranger-Rylander game last night. I was rooting for a tie.
But here's the thing about it. No team is always going to win. That is just a reality. Is it the mark of a good fan base that sticks with its team, whether it wins or loses, or will only support a winner? Because if your business model is predicated on always winning, then from a macro point of view, you're sunk.
Yeah.
You really are. Now, Florida is, unfortunately, a freak in all this because their losing has, you know, an entrail to it. They have like losing chemtrails for years. Like it's 18 years they've been in the playoffs once. Is that the stat or 13 years? 16? I can't remember exactly.
Who, Florida?
But it's odious. It's awful.
It's terrible. Yeah.
That's why, and it's funny too because I always thought that the low taxation, or the lack of state tax, was going to be like a Pied Piper for a lot of free agents. That really hasn't happened. Other than guys that just want to string it out for a couple of years and you know pick up a paycheck at the end of their career.
The quote unquote veteran players always seem to end up in Florida.
Yeah, everyone says they want to play for Florida. No one says they want to play for the Panthers. It's like Coyotes were like that for so long. Oh yeah, I want to play for Phoenix. Want to play for the Coyotes? I want to play for Phoenix and I want to golf after practice every day. But what is the mark of a real fan?
A member of this country club.
What is the mark of a fan? What is the mark of a fan base though? And again, Florida is the freak because it's been losses compounded upon losses for a lot of years.
I understand what you're saying about the necessity to win being the thing that draws fans and how that could be unsustainable because winning is cyclical. I understand that. But the idea that we've seen, I mean, think about the Panthers. It's a generation of fans that have been lost. I mean, like a generation of fans that are just completely apathetic to the product because the team never wins. I'm saying that you don't have to necessarily win every season, but you do need a few years to kind of entice people and have them buy in and start living and dying with this team. And that's what's happened in Columbus. They minted new fans last year. No question about that. Mm-hmm. And they've minted new fans in the last couple of years.
Yep.
And the same thing with Nashville when they went on their playoff runs. It's that's what you need to happen, and Florida's not had that for over a decade. And right. I don't know if South Florida is a viable hockey market. It may not be. They may need to move. I completely am not saying that anyone who thinks that South Florida can't support the Panthers is completely wrong. I'm just saying the jury's out. I'm saying the jury's out because there's been no way to test it. If you have a team, and in some ways Arizona is the same way, because when they were successful in the last few years under Dave Tippett, what was happening? They had one skate out the door every year. Who's buying into this team? Who's living and dying with this team if at the end of the playoff run they're in Hamilton or they're in Seattle? Like, who's going to buy into that? Who's going to give a shit? So I'm a real big proponent of trying to test markets after we've seen them through a few years of winning, and if the fans are coming or if they're not coming, and then what happens in the next couple of years when they don't win? What do the fans react there? I just think that a team that's been a doormat for over a decade, like the Panthers have been, you can't judge it. And you certainly can't judge it now that all they're doing is trying to build value back into their tickets by not papering the building anymore, which I think is virtuous.
I agree with what Flora's doing there. It's going to be pain, but listen, you got to rip that bandage off, and you got to see who's really coming. You got to see who's really coming to the games and who's really paying for the games. I support the Panthers 100% in what they're doing. It may visually look bad, and as Ellen Etchingham once said, when you see curtains in an arena, when I see curtains, I think funerals, and it's not always going to look good, but still. In one of the most candid answers he's ever given me in an interview, this is 2007, maybe 2008, talking to Gary Bettman, I said, when do you know when a franchise is done? Like, when do you know when it's over for a franchise? When do you know there's no hope and that's it? And he said, quite bluntly, when no one wants to buy it.
Yeah, that's what happened in Atlanta.
And that hasn't happened in Phoenix, and that hasn't happened in Broward County. Hasn't. That's when a market is done, when nobody wants to buy it.
The other aspect, I'm happy you mentioned Broward County. I mean, the other aspect of this is that there is, movement afoot to maybe get them out of their lease. And there's also movement afoot from the ownership, because it's been the situation for years where they're trying to squeeze more money out of the county. So the worse they look, the easier both of those things are going to be to accomplish. So there's other factors at play here as far as the attendance goes.
Listen, man, when everyone was having a whack at the pinata the other day on Twitter, I stayed away because I've seen this happen in too many markets. I saw it happen in Chicago. Listen, we're going to talk to Barry Trotz here in a couple of seconds. I saw this happen in Washington. There are plenty of times those rinks were barren, right?
There were.
And then what happened?
How did Washington do it? I'll tell you how they did it. They built value back into their tickets. I interviewed a marketing guy for them, I think it was before the lockout in 2005. And he said, look, we've had to paper the building a little bit because we moved from Landover to D.C., and a lot of our fan base didn't come automatically because they're afraid of the city, and they're from different parts of the area. And we had to paper the building a little bit, and that was a problem. And that's not how you build value into your tickets. So they stopped. And then Ovechkin comes, and now all of a sudden they're winning a little bit, and now they have a fan base that may be on the cusp of it but isn't quite there yet insofar as the we're not going to show up anymore. They're showing up. But that could be one of those markets that in a couple of years is one of those, well, we have to get the fans back and do something dramatic kind of situations. I mean, and by that I mean an American market, because Canadian markets never do that.
Y'all, first of all, that's a folly because, I mean, Ottawa was on the brink once upon a time. There was a Canadian Emergency Assistance Program put together, sorry Canadians, by Gary Bettman to help bail out franchises like the Calgary Flames and the Edmonton Oilers when the Canadian dollar bottomed out. There were plenty of nights, although Canadian fans don't like to hear it, that we went to Vancouver Canucks games and there were plenty of fans dressed up as empty seats. So let's not pretend that it hasn't happened in Canada as we play this whack the Florida Panthers pinata. I just didn't want any part of it because I've seen it happen in too many markets in the U.S. and also in markets in Canada. It's a lazy, easy, oh, look at them, no one's going. To me, boring story.
I will vehemently defend American markets. I don't believe that if you have a team that doesn't sell out every night that somehow makes you less virtuous than a Canadian market. I think the bigger the footprint can be for the NHL. This is where I agree with Bettman. The bigger the footprint can be for the NHL, the better it's going to be for the league. That's how I feel. And it's not even, it's not even trying to get more markets to watch it. It's not even this. It's tapping into new places to grow players and grow the game. I mean, we've talked on this show a lot of times about the number of players that are coming out of California. This is an important thing for hockey.
We're talking about Florida here a second ago. I mean, how close was Shane Gostisbehere to making the Philadelphia Flyers this year?
Right.
Pretty close.
And because, as you've mentioned before on the show, there is a point of saturation that is reached in Canada when it comes to audience and player growth.
And look at Phoenix. Auston Matthews may be the first overall draft pick next year in the NHL. He grew up in Phoenix. He was a Phoenix Coyotes fan. Greg, our guest, is standing by.
Joining us now on the line, a man who came from one of those deplorable small American markets that the Canadians are always trying to steal teams from, and is now the proud coach of the Washington Capitals in D.C. He is Barry Trotz, and he joins us again here on the Merrick Wisniewski podcast. Barry, before we get to the Caps, we've been talking all morning about the Panthers, relocation, non-traditional markets, that whole thing. Talk a little bit about how you saw Nashville grow as a market while you were there as coach.
Well, Nashville was a great example of, I think, a success story in the new markets. I mean, they look at a team like San Jose, which we played last night. That's another good example. If you would have said to people 20 years ago, would you have hockey in San Jose, California? People would say you're crazy, and it's a great market. So I think Nashville is following in those footsteps of a team like San Jose, a real good market. It's a city that's learning hockey, and they're sort of starting to get into that next generation. When I got there, there was no kids really playing hockey. Now they're building rinks. There's more kids playing hockey. There's a really good, strong fan base, and they know the game. And that's what you want. I said that my legacy in Nashville will probably be that, that's been my home. So that's probably where, my grandma, sit there and watch a hockey, NHL hockey in Nashville, Tennessee with my grandkids. I think that'll be real special, and that we were able to stabilize that. It was a tough first couple of years, but I think it's a great market now.
Yeah, that's key. And you mentioned San Jose. I think it took 15 years for one player to be born in San Jose and drafted into the NHL. Maybe 20 years. I can't remember the exact number. And Dallas is the same. Dallas has a good grassroots program. Nashville, as you mentioned as well. The key really at the end of it is build the grassroots program. And Barry, as you well know, get sticks in kids' hands as soon as possible.
Absolutely. And I think what you'll find in these markets is that, you're starting to build ranks, but some of the players have a big say in it. Some of the players who are retiring in Nashville, Tennessee, J.P. Dumont and Jim McKenzie and Stu Grimson and people like that who played in the NHL, they're now involved in minor hockey, they're involved with Predators or whatever. Those markets grow because of those people. And when those markets grow, you start seeing, kids from the Dallas area, California, Nashville, Tennessee, they're now playing in the National Hockey League. And I always said that there's a war of northern aggression, that we didn't want teams in the States, and we wanted more in Canada, and I get all that. But we got such a great game that if we can have it all in North America, I think it's fantastic and around the world. And the great thing about the new, non-traditional markets down in the States is that, in fact, there's more kids and people playing hockey in the United States of America now than all of Canada, which is, you said that 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah, I think the growth rate, Barry, is in Canada, the growth rate for boys, for girls, is much higher. But for boys, I think it's at 2.5%, where in the United States it's closer to 6%. So it's not as if the game isn't growing in Canada. It's just growing at a bigger rate in the United States.
Yeah, and, the population is also, 10 times the population. So you get more and more athletes playing the game, and you're getting more facilities built, and that's the key. If you don't have the facilities, you're not going to play ice hockey if you don't have the rinks.
Yeah, and I will also point out, of course, that that's with global warming, so let's all celebrate that.
Well, here's one of the things I cannot understand, and I'm off the subject on a soapbox. One of the things that keep costs down for young players is obviously ice time's so big. I don't know why us non-traditional markets and more of the Sun Belts, why we don't use solar energy on top of our buildings. There's a big blank space, and the biggest costs for arenas are, in fact, electricity. So if someone should jump on that idea, I get a piece of that if they
and do. Well, that's right. Andrew Ferentz, move over. There's a new leader to the Green that's Initiative right. in the NHL.
Absolutely.
It's Barry Trotz, Washington Capitals head coach. It's a good idea, Barry.
Barry Trotz, the man who invented ice through sunlight. That is your legacy, sir. All right. So as a coach, are you mostly happy they rallied from 3-0 down and got a point at that thing, or are you kind of upset that they went 3-0 down?
I think as a coach, you're upset you go 3-0 down, but then you look at the goals, and it's sometimes it's ice hockey. I mean, they had three scoring chances in the first period. All of them went in. And we were looking at them today, and if you know, like Fulbright and Holtby, if those goals were scored in three separate games, I would say, oh, he had no chance on that one. You screened really well on that one. You'd probably wouldn't even think twice. It would just be a normal hockey goal. But they happened, all three of them. They had three scoring chances, three in the net. We changed the mojo. Yesterday before the game, I was, after the first period, I was not happy. But, when I went home last night and then I talked to our team this morning, as I said, the great thing about that is that we had the ability to come back. We had the wherewithal to come back from a three-goal deficit twice and a two-goal deficit once to get a point against arguably the best team out of the blocks in the National Hockey League. So that says a lot about where we are or where we're going.
An interesting point as well, and many people have made this point, and it's not just with your Caps, but previous with Adam Oates, with Hunter, and before with Bruce as well. Two goals last night for Alexander Ovechkin in the gameplay, but when it came to the shootout, it was Backstrom, it was Kuznetsov, it was Eric Fehr. A lot of eyebrows are always raised when Alexander Ovechkin isn't in the shootout. Why, Barry, yeah, from the coach's point of view?
Actually, I this is funny you ask that. I asked the same thing, and the shootout percentages based on, this is my analytics approach, which all the media is all over. Alex has the fifth best scoring percentage in the National, or not in the National Hockey League, but you know, on our team.
Right.
And so he was actually, I moved him up. He was going to be the fourth shooter. And we practiced the shootout and all that. Some guys aren't great at it. It was great. Last night, might want to redo it. I thought he had a pretty good hand, so that's why I moved him up to the four hole. The other three guys have been pretty money for us, based on, you know, what I've seen in practice, what we've seen at different areas. I mean, Kuznetsov had just been in a string of scoring 14 of his last 16 attempts in KHL and NHL, so I was going to go with him, and Nick Backstrom's usually pretty good money, and he's number two on our team in terms of overall shooting percentage when it comes to shootouts. And Alex is down the list a little bit. You know, Wayne Gretzky didn't even want to take him. He might have been the best player of all time. So shootouts is a little bit of a different animal sometimes.
Now that you've been there through camp and a few games, is there anybody on the team that you maybe didn't realize something about that you realize about them now that you've been coaching them?
Well, there's 23 guys that I could probably answer that question to, just because it's a new team. But I will tell you this, that I knew Nick Backstrom was a good player. I didn't realize how great of a player he was. He is all as good as any, a Joe Thornton when it comes to the passing and making plays. And he's as good as a Bergeron when he's going head to head against him. I mean, he's a complete player, and he does it with such ease, and he does it under the radar. And this guy's an absolute superstar that I would put him out against anybody in the National Hockey League, and he could be, he's as complete a player as you're going to find.
I want to ask you about Alexander Ovechkin and how you coach him. I mean, with all due respect to the players you had on the Predators, this is the first time in a lot of ways, Barry, you've been able to drive a Ferrari. I mean, he really is that type of player. And if you look at his last three coaches previous to you, whether it was Adam Oates or Dale Hunter or Bruce Boudreau, those were all forwards when they played. You're a Regina Pats defenseman coming out of the Western League, coached by Brian Murray and Jack Sangster, and we all think of Sangster's gangsters. How do you handle Alexander Ovechkin, coming at it from your point of view?
Well, I think honesty and being honest and fair and being concise with him of what exactly I want. And I think, you know, I got to spend some time with Alex. We got to know each other. We still don't know each other, but I think there's a level of trust. You see, you know, I've had three coaches come in here and said, you know, boy, you've got Ovi playing a really solid two-way game. And I said, no, I appreciate that, but really it's really Alex Ovechkin that's doing it. I'm giving him some tips. He's following it. Like last night, I thought he was as good as any player. He might have been the best player on the ice. He got two goals. He was physical. The 235-pound body was slamming guys. He blocked a couple of critical blocks. He's in position. He's been a force, and he's in that all three games for us. So he's a player that cares. I heard a lot of, you know, all the questions I got is, you know, Alex is not really controllable or doesn't listen, and that's absolutely the total opposite. He listens, he cares, he wants to be a better player, and I think I've just been honest, and whatever connection that we have, I think plain and simple, it's all about the team, and he really is all about the team. Some of my, I'll say, perceptions were way off. I'm glad that I was way off in a lot of those perceptions.
Rare is the player in the National Hockey League that can make a big impact in just over 5 minutes of average ice time. But every time the Caps play, Liam O'Brien's name seems to be all over Twitter. What is the deal with Liam O'Brien and the impact he's making for you this year?
Well, here's a player that came into development camp, and he was actually injured for a good part of it. He had a cut on his ankle, which is right on where you tie your skate, and so he missed a good part of that, but I think he listened and learned, and then he got into the scrimmage and played quite well, and then he came into our rookie camp and just seemed to be getting better and better. And then he's as hard a guy as you're going to meet, but he's got some ability, which is fantastic. He gets around the ice quite well. He's hard to play against, and he gets to those hard areas. And every night he's either pulling us into the fight, he's either getting a scoring chance or creating scoring chances, or he's having an impact on the game. And as he keeps growing, I think we have a good player in Liam O'Brien. He is, I think he's that right type of player that the National Hockey League is going to, a hard-nosed, physical, hard to play against type of guy who can give you good minutes. I know his minutes are a little bit limited right now, but I could see him playing on a regular sort of third line or even a fourth line that you use a four line mentality with, that he would be fine. I mean, I see him killing penalties down the road. I see him moving up and playing higher role. I mean, he's just gotten better and better as he's stayed with us. His ability to handle the speed and the pucks and the thinking process of the higher level has been exceptional. He's been really, really good and really a good team player.
I don't know, Barry. I was trying to think about this the other week when he made the team. I don't know, Barry, if I've ever seen a player go through the NHL draft twice and then make an NHL team at a camp the next season. I'm scratching my brain trying to figure one out.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can come up with any, but I've had good fortune over the course of time that we've had players that either someone in the organization has seen or maybe I've seen or a coaching staff has seen or it's just, you know, as much as it is just great timing for that individual, but it's people that get there to at their own pace. You know, the Andrew Burnett's, the Joel Wards that I had in Nashville, give you some old names like Yachmanev, yeah, and people like that who were out of the league and came back into the league as really good players. So hopefully this is a young guy who's just found his stride. He didn't find his stride at 18 and 19, but he's finding his stride at 20 and 21.
Barry, I can honestly tell you, Barry, when I woke up this morning, I never thought that I would hear the name Vitaly Yachmanev again. So thank you for that, reminding me of that name from the NHL. That was awesome.
Yeah, he was one of those exceptionally smart players,
yep,
that never got any credit for what great instincts he had as a player.
He wakes up every morning hoping to hear that, so it's very exciting for him. Finally for me, Barry, what is the status report, progress report on super rookie Evgeny Kuznetsov? Do you think there's a chance he could play his way up to a bigger role in this lineup, or is it just a bit of a learning curve for him?
I think he's a player that's getting better and better. You know, he's going into the new position in a new, you know, obviously he played some games last year in Washington in the smaller rink, but he's playing center ice. Him and Burkowski are converted wingers that we stuck in the middle. And I see Kuzi's skill level just sort of just going better and better. Him and Burkowski are two players that I think you get to the 40-game mark, they're going to be pretty high in our lineup right now. They're both sort of in the, I would say, in the top 10 in the lineup right now in terms of our overall team. I could see them getting into the, you know, the top seven.
And finally for me, and this story will involve a Russian name, let's get a quick story out of Barry Trotz. Barry, take us back to, I want to say it's 1998. It's an exhibition game. The first pro game, I believe, in Arkansas. It's your Preds against the Dallas Stars. It's at the State Fairgrounds, and it's paper airplane night. And I believe the story involves Sergei Krivokrasov. Can you fill us in on that one?
I remember the we were doing the exhibition game, and I believe it was the was it Blaine Stoughton who was sort of handling that?
The old Cardford Whaler.
Yeah. And so they had this contest at the end of the game. If you make these paper airplanes, you put your name on the paper, and someone sponsored this bass boat, and you were going to throw these paper airplanes, the closest one to center ice wins the bass boat. Well, we ended up in, I think, a 1-1 tie or 2-2 tie. Well, all of a sudden, all these paper airplanes come on the ice, and instead of going to overtime and the shootout, we just ended the game right there. And it'll go down in my book when I write it and when I'm done playing the game and coaching in this game. But it was a new, unique thing, because when you're a non-traditional market, you went to non-traditional places, you had non-traditional things happen to you that are funny.
You know, it's funny, but I remember talking once upon a time to the original play-by-play voice of the Birmingham Bulls. The old WHA team came over from Toronto. And I asked it, what did fans in Birmingham get really excited about? I thought it would be like the fights or the big goals, slap shots, you know, WHA kind of stuff. Big hair, mustaches. He said, whenever we did a wholesale line change, the place went crazy. Because when you think about it, hockey's the only sport where all five guys, while the play's going on, can leave the surface, and five more came back. He said, in Birmingham, this gave fans the biggest thrill of all time. So when you hear the Krivokrasov story scoring to tie things up, and here come the paper airplanes, I always think of that Birmingham Bulls story where five, you know, wholesale line changes are getting standing ovations.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was funny. My first game in Nashville, they stood the whole warm-up.
Really?
So, yeah. The place was packed. It was our opening game, and they stood the whole warm-up. And I don't know if you know anything about when the Nets came in or not. Obviously you do, but people did not realize that those pucks are really hard. And in warm up, if you're not paying attention, you're behind the net. You are probably going to get hit with one of those. And I remember the going out for warm up and watching the other team. And I know crowds of people, like 8 or 9 behind our net. Up in the stands that were, you know, crowded around people who got hit with pucks, and our medical staff and the building staff were on overload that night because people didn't realize that those things were coming over the glass.
Yeah, those frozen back black things, they kind of stink. Barry, this has been a real delight. Best of luck the rest of the way with the Caps, and we'll catch up soon.
All right, take care.
The great Barry Trotz.
That was awesome.
The dude, like, I love talking hockey with Barry Trotz.
He's great.
Every time I talk to that guy, he's got because he's, you know what he is, he's a student of the game,
mm-hmm.
and he's a guy who understands that there is more to talk about than simply your own lineup, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, and he's an old school. I mean, he had some great coaches in junior. He had Brian Murray, now of course with the Otters, and he had Jack Sangster, who when he coached, I remember this reference, when he coached Seattle was. That was the era of the Thug Squad in the Western League, and it was a team called Sangster's Gangsters, and that's what the Western Loop was. And he played very briefly before he went to Kitchener with Al McInnes, who was his roommate. He played with Doug Wickenheiser when he put up those huge seasons for the Regina Pats. And then he became, you know, a hockey lifer coach, to the point where when he coached the Baltimore Skipjacks, and get him to tell the story more so than me, because the owner of the Skipjacks, the late Tom Ebright, was so cheap. The coach didn't get his own room. he had to room with the play-by-play voice. So you know who Barry Trotz lived with?
Who?
The play-by-play voice of the Baltimore Skipjacks was Kenny Albert.
The Kenny Albert.
Yeah, man. He lived with Kenny Albert. Because Kenny was the Skipjacks voice in the American League. Should have got him. Well, next time we have Barry on, we'll get him to tell stories of living with Kenny Albert.
I have to admit that I tuned out a little bit as soon as you said that that Brian Murray was involved. So I could think of his him saying Barry Trotz's name.
Yeah. Crush. I know. It's the obvious one. I know. That's why they had to trade Hossa. I know. We've heard all the jokes. I know.
Crush.
I had to get rid of Spezza, too. I know.
Crush. Let's talk about fighting. Because, you know, we really need to ratchet up the show a little bit more.
We need to get the emotional timber a little higher on the show today. Can we just go back to talking about smoking pot and watching hockey games?
Fighting became a thing for the show. It might have been last year or the year before, and it became a real divisive thing. Because we were talking about fighting at a time when, you know, it was this concussion crisis and the CTE and the whole thing, and fighting was it might have been around the Peros thing, actually. And so last night, Jerome Iginla and Dion Phaneuf almost fought. Dropped the gloves. Fight was broken up. And social media blew up with these laments from people saying, how dare you break up that fight? We all want to see Jerome Iginla beat the crap out of his former teammate, which is exactly what would have happened. And, you know, it was one of those moments where, again, you look at this fighting thing that we deal with in hockey. And I feel like there's two camps on the other side of the equation, because I think we could still safely say that you and I are both pro-fighting people, yes?
At the NHL level, I could see it dying, Junior. Thank you very much. Pretty
right.
simply,
those NHL level
brains are
NHL
level. But at the NHL all level, right. Yeah, I have no problem with the fight. I won't call the police. It's okay.
Some of the anti-fighting people are reasonable, and I agree with some of it. Staged fights are a problem. Fights off the face-off when it's been set up beforehand can be a problem. This is circusy stuff that slows down the game
and stage fights.
Sometimes can be a little distracting and unproblem. I mean, it's you don't need the fights. But the fights that happened during the course of the game, like the Iggy Dion fight last night would have been, are perfectly okay. It's the others, and it's also they also lament the existence of goons. Although sometimes I feel like that's a lament from like 2004, back when we actually had goons, instead of there only being maybe like seven left. In the league right now that can't play the game but are only there to fight. But the other part of the anti-fighting group is the part I find problematic.
John Scott scored a goal last night, sir. John Scott scored last night.
He is a goal, sir.
Please.
The other part of the anti-fighting group that I think is problematic is when I see people that otherwise lament the existence of fighting trying to tell me which fights are okay and which fights aren't. If it's a player safety issue, I'm sorry. You need to be anti-fighting across the board. There are no good fights if it's a player safety issue. And I know you might say, well, I have a problem with guys who fight all the time. They shouldn't fight all the time. But a fight's a fight. It's still a guy getting rocked in his brain by someone else's fist. So the thing that bothers me is when I see people sometimes look at the Dion Iggy fight, lament the fact that it didn't happen, and being like, well, that's a good fight. It's a virtuous fight. All fights are inherently evil, but that's an okay fight. Or tell me that certain people should be able to fight and certain people shouldn't fight. Or that some fights are good and some fights are bad. As if the brain is more well protected when two guys that can put 20 goals up are fighting spontaneously than if it was two goons with a planned fight. If you're a player safety person, just be against it across the board. Don't try to modulate your opinion on what fights are virtuous and what fights aren't. But if you're someone who's a bit more reasonable, a bit more middle ground, you say, you know what? I don't need to see Colton Orr fight again, but if Dion wants to fight Iggy, that's all right by me. Then I think that you are maybe hitting it where it should be right now, 2014 fighting debate.
You know who had the best take on it last night? Jeff O'Neill.
Who's that?
Jeff O'Neill's take was awesome. He essentially said, look, if you're a linesman, and I know the linesmen are encouraged when they have a chance, if they can break up a fight before it happens, you break up a fight before it happens. But when you have something as potentially momentous as two former the province of Alberta would have exploded. If you have two former Calgary Flames, Dion Phaneuf and Jerome Iginla, about to throw down, if you're one of the linesmen, couldn't you have stepped on a glove? just to make sure that you couldn't have gotten in between before they locked up. Oops, I slipped. Like, is it, are, like, the underlying point is really, like, I mean, officials have a job to do, too, but, I mean, can't you just be a hockey fan for a second here, Liney? Can't you just maybe step on a puck, Liney, and maybe just, oops, I didn't get a chance. Sorry, didn't get a chance to break that one up. Sorry about that. Yeah. I thought that was the best take
it
on all
to
of
be
it.
A little bit more
step
of that.
On a glove.
I love that.
Just
step
happened.
On a glove. It's perfect.
Yeah,
it was a fight I wanted to see. And the reaction to it on Twitter was pretty interesting. But, yeah, I mean, if you're anti-fighting and it's about player safety, then there are no good fights. But
here's the thing
who
about
just players. Wants to play the garbage fights out of the game, then I think you've hit the sweet spot.
Here's the thing about the player safety factor when it comes to concussions, for example. Most body checks that I see, like big body checks, even clean, okay, shoulder to chest, the ones we all say we love, I still maintain are more dangerous than fights. And if you ask many doctors, you don't have to get hit in the head to have a concussion. There's a big myth out there that you have to get hit in the head for your brain to knock against your skull. Not true. I mean, you can actually, I've talked to one doctor in the summer who said, you know, you can get a concussion from a punch in the stomach, let alone getting a shoulder in the solar
plexus. If
your
body is jostled.
That can concuss you.
Yeah.
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 Like, I see, if you're going to go the player safety route, then don't tell me that big crunching, quote-unquote, clean body checks are fine. That's the way the game should be played. Oh, but fighting. Oh, man. We need to think of the brains of these athletes. This is a boring.
I was just on another podcast the other day, and fighting came up. And again, like, it is that classic conundrum for the league. How do you have quasi-endorsement of fighting and have increasingly draconian rules on player safety and hits to the head? It makes no sense. They can't make sense of it. Other than saying the fights are concussions both people agree to have. And the hits to the head, that's one party, you know, and the other one doesn't know what's happening.
Yeah.
So it's nonsensical. But anyways, real brief on the Islanders. Was really impressed last night with watching the Islanders beat the Rangers. Four goals in the third period. Lundqvist lit up like a Christmas tree, although his team in front of him, Michael Koska, Jesus, terrible, didn't help him.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I like him. Aurora Tigers.
But the three things that I think are pretty solid about the Islanders right now and may continue to be throughout the season. Halak saved their bacon. I'm not a huge Halak guy. I don't like him for more than maybe like 55 games in a season. But 40 saves last night.
Is that because he's too small? Is that because
he's too
small for you?
And he's never done it. He's never been the workhorse. And there are certain guys that can and certain guys that can't. And I don't think he can. I think he's better in a platoon personally. But he was great last night and he 40 saves kept him in a game. And really, you know, it's those moments where you look at a performance like that and say, had that been anybody on the roster last season, they would have been toast in that game. And then
Hey Wish.
You know, yeah.
I think there's a little time stagger here. Let me hang up and then call back in. Let me get a little bit of a time stagger on.
Oh, okay.
Try to call back in and get a better line. Hold on. Stand by.
Do that.
Maddie, I'm calling back in.
Hang up. This is me hanging up. Watch.
There goes Merrick.
And I'm gone.
I like, I poo-pooed the Nick Leddy and Johnny Boychuk stuff a little bit because Islanders fans are treating it like it was the second coming. If they had signed Lidstrom and Orr, or traded for Lidstrom and Orr. And, Boychuk's been great for them. Really, really good for them in the first three games. And Leddy, put up his first goal last night too. So, that's solid. Their defense is, remarkably better because of those two. And finally, I wrote about him this morning. You know, the Brock Nelson thing has been a nice story. He's not someone who's come out of nowhere. Like, Islanders fans are aware of this kid. 14 goals last year, lit up Bridgeport a couple years back. You know, he's a guy that people know, but now he's starting to hit the scoring sheet. And he's hitting it because of this line he's on with Stroman and Grabowski, which is, you know, a great little secondary scoring line behind the Tavares line who's going to always see the top defensive assignment. And there's a lot to like about the Islanders right now.
Ryan Strome looks like a better skater to you. I mean, all the way through junior playing with Niagara and in Bridgeport and all that, you kept hearing, oh, duck foot skater. He looks like a better skater to me this year.
He is, but he's making some young bad. He had three turnovers in the same shift last night. He's making some bad mistakes still. But that line's got the potential to be something pretty good. And his little pass behind the net to Nelson in front last night was a thing to watch. I like him. I feel real good. I feel as good about picking the Islanders to make the playoffs as I feel bad having picked Minnesota to miss the playoffs.
I just wish that Jack Capuano were chubbier and was a better talker and could be the Paul Heyman to Brock Nelson's Brock Lesnar.
I know. Brock Nelson. I was watching Capuano last night talk. Now that I'm in the city, I'm going to be obviously covering the Islanders and Rangers and Devils more. And I was watching him talk for the first time in a while. And yeah, I wish he was fatter. But the whole time you listen to Capuano talk, the whole time you just believe in the back of his head, he's like, I just want to get through this thing and go have myself a beer, maybe a pastrami sandwich, maybe a slice.
I told you why I love Capuano. When he lost all that weight, didn't buy new suits.
I know.
I'm going back, fellas.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going back, so I'm keeping suits.
Looking like a kid wearing his father's suit to his confirmation.
So true.
It's so awesome. Great. All right. I believe now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a Wednesday favorite.
Time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Not that deep.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Kim writes in, hi, y'all.
Y'all.
She writes in, by the way, please bring the NHL to Seattle. I can't afford tickets to the Canucks. Kim writes in, hey, I asked Jeff this last night via Twitter, but thought I'd elaborate in email. Okay. It's three games into the season. But the thing that continues to stick out is that the Oilers look like they don't know what to do on the ice. Putting aside the fact that when they're down by a couple goals, they look like kicked puppies. They look like there are so many systemic options that their heads might explode trying to decide what to do with the puck. My question is Dallas Eakins a good quote but a bad teacher?
Oh, boy. The Oilers' problems are deep, and you really saw them last night against a very good Los Angeles Kings team led by a very good line of Jeff Carter, Tanner Pearson, and Tyler Toffoli. What's happening to the Oilers is kind of the same thing that we've seen happen for a number of years to Edmonton. They get pushed around. Now, they didn't help themselves last night because Eberle's out, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is out, two of their better defensemen, one is scratched, and Jeff Petrie, hello trade. And the other, Martin Marincin, is playing for Oklahoma City. So that doesn't help. Going into this one, I mean, it had all the makings of a slaughter. So you can say to yourself, okay, well, that is the litmus test because the Los Angeles Kings are the defending Stanley Cup champions, and that is your measuring stick. I still think they are too small of a team. They're still a team that gets pushed around by a very big Western Conference. And I still maintain, I don't know what all this losing has done to all those kids.
It makes them fold
for a long time.
Yeah, when they're faced with adversity, it makes them fold.
But, I don't know. I mean, as far as coaching goes, I mean, I'm not there in the coaching meetings. I'm not there for the morning skates. I can tell you what Dallas Eakins was like as a head coach of the Marlies. It's a different issue because it's American Hockey League players, and you have their, let's just say, you have their attention a lot more than you have a 24-year-old's attention who has a 6-year, $40 million contract in his hip pockets.
Well, there are different
challenges in Edmonton than there were in the American League for Dallas.
Are you saying there may be a problem with attention span and motivation when you're young, barely legal drinking age players been locked up in perpetuity? Are you saying that might not have been the smartest thing to do?
I don't know. I mean, so you started off. What did you start this podcast off by talking about? Was it Canadian entitlement? No, Canadian Eric. What did you talk about this? Anyway, there's a lot of young.
We were talking about the Edmonton Oilers' inability to sign free agents, and that's why you signed those guys.
And that's part of it too. That's a message to the marketplace that we're locking these guys up, and they're going to stay here. And listen, Edmonton's got, when the salary cap came in, the money was the same for everybody, as we know. So you had to be able to sell different things. And if you're on a winning team, you can sell that we're on a winning team. But when you're not a winning team, the sell becomes harder. Mm-hmm. It really does, and it becomes challenging when you're Edmonton.
Just remember, friends, that a vote for more Canadian franchises is a vote for teams that will never win the Cup and that can't attract free agents. Just remember that. Andrew Ketterer writes in,
now, hang
First
on a
of
second.
All, love the
hang
show.
On, hang on, hang on,
yes.
hang on. I was ripped, and rightly so, for ending yesterday's podcast by saying, I think the Oilers look like a better team this year so far. And then they went out and soundly got trounced by the Los Angeles Kings. But I still do maintain. Now, yesterday was a slaughter, and there's some key pieces that were out of the lineup, and that had all the makings of, oh, geez, Helter Skelter. I still maintain they are a better team this year.
Any team that's missing two out of their top six is, you know, in trouble, especially against the defending cup champions. So let's keep that in mind.
They play Arizona.
Andrew Ketterer writes in, first of all, love the show, guys. It gets me through traffic to and from work. Keep up the awesome work. I want to hear both your thoughts on the Red Wings. I feel like everyone is down on Detroit this year, and I don't understand. Not much has changed from last year other than their health and the experience level of their young talent. Wouldn't the natural assumption be that they'll be even better than last year? Just interested to hear what you two think. I don't trust the health, though. That's one of the issues, is I don't trust Zetterberg's back to hold up for a full season. Franzen's a guy whose health I don't trust. Now all of a sudden, Pavel Datsyuk gets banged up here and there. Is there things to like? Are there things liked about this team? Of course there are. A lot of the young players are good. And obviously Gustav Nyquist, all of a sudden, 2 goals, 2 games. Look at him, mm-hmm. picking up where he left off. And there's Anthony, stuff to like about him, but Anthony Mantha
down the road is going to be a really good hockey player in the NHL.
Yeah.
Good players on the horizon.
I see him as a bubble team. They're not as good as the Bruins. They're not as good as Montreal. They're not as good as Tampa Bay. And I just feel like they're going to be right on the outside looking in. Is that being down on them, or is that just calling them what they are, which is an average team?
Detroit's playing Boston tonight, and Pavel Datsyuk's still not in the lineup. To the point about, you know, health with this team and how once you hit a certain age, your health issues sort of compound themselves, and that what you could shake off or skate through or play through when you're 22 years old, you can't do when you're 32 or 35 years old anymore.
Right.
And that's, I mean, that core of Detroit sort of getting to that age.
Let me ask you a going postal question.
Okay, flaccid
would
or erect.
Would we be having a different conversation? And this is a real sort of what if Marvel Comics kind of thing. Would we be having this conversation if they had found a way to recruit Ryan Suter as a free agent? Not Parise, just Suter.
Probably.
They'd still be kind of where they are.
No. I think they'd be a significantly better team. That's always been in a lot of ways, as much as I would Zetterberg and Datsyuk. I mean, the strength of the Detroit Red Wings, this previous incarnation, was always led by the defense, and that was where Kenny Holland always built from. It's funny if you go back, and you know there are people that follow the team a lot closer than I do, but I would suspect that when you talk about, you know, the unraveling of this team and where it really happened, when that defense started to fall apart, that was it. When that was it for Lidstrom, and that was it for Rafalski, and Stewart's mm-hmm. game fell, and you're left with Cronwell, who I love, but without those other three guys, it's challenging.
DeKeyser will be good. I mean, they've got guys back there, but it's just not the
good,
same class.
But dude, like Lidstrom, Rafalski, oh, a healthy, really good. Like Brad Stewart's game has fallen off a lot, but man, when he played with Detroit. Looks fantastic.
You may want to tell Joe Sakic that. Abby Gambrill writes in, she wants to reinvent the draft.
Okay. I'm in.
She's worried about tanking, as we all are. Yeah. She wants to reinvent the draft. What if the first round of the draft was a reverse draft? Now, that doesn't mean reverse order, ladies and gentlemen. Hear her out.
Okay.
What if the top 30 CSS-ranked skaters picked their own teams? Would that fix tanking, reward effort at the junior level? Let the players choose where they're going in the draft, but have it be where, obviously, once a team is off the board, you can't go there anymore.
Oh, I get it. Okay, so you take... Okay, well, then again, it comes down to you have to get 30 teams to agree on a very specific scouting service. I guess it would be...
Connor McDavid will go into the draft and choose where he would like to play. And then Jack Eichel will. And so on and so forth.
Wow. That really would be cool. It'll never happen in a million years. I still like the idea of, and I say, shooting myself in the foot about this because we have the draft starting this year on Sportsnet. But there is something very intriguing about just getting rid of the draft altogether because you have a salary cap and you just need to manage money. And you're not going to be able to maybe afford Noah Hanifin or Kyle Shillington or Dylan Strome. You'll make room for Eichel. You'll make room for Connor McDavid. But there is something to be said for that. But her point, her idea is a really interesting one. Go choose where you want to play. I love the idea,
yeah, of that happening. And, like, Connor McDavid gets to choose where he wants to play. And all of a sudden, there's a knock at his door. Oh, it's Brendan Shanahan.
Connor, I just wanted to let you know, by no means is this trying to influence your decision, but we've purchased for your parents the moon. The moon is now owned by your parents. Rogers and Bell have a lot of money. We thought it'd be a nice gift, so we've given them the moon. But do as you please. I mean, no pressure, no pressure.
Your choice. It's yours as long as you sign here. We're just sort of holding it in escrow right now. Well, unlock. You have the key to unlock that if you sign here. Your choice.
That's right. We'd be happy to hand over the moon if you decide to come to Toronto. But if you don't, then then we'll probably put our practice facility up there. You know, have people fly up there and see us play up there.
By the way, for all of you Doctor Who fans, the Kill the Moon episode was great. I thought just an aside for the nerds out there. Finally, the final one.
Oh, okay.
For the day, I'm going postal. We got one more, right? I think we could do one more.
Sure, man. Sure.
I just had it and now I've lost it. Hang on here. Here it goes. Ready? Mark Borak writes in, "What's up with John Tortorella?" Now he's not. Correct me if I'm wrong. He is not commentating on either TSN or Sportsnet at the moment.
It's not with us. Our latest signing yesterday was Todd Warner for a junior package. Yo, big ups from a Windsor Spitfire Kitchener Ranger. And I don't know. I haven't seen him on TSN, so I think he is underground counting his money.
He's underground counting his money, as is Dan Bylsma, one would assume. But both those guys are available. Look, I think Bylsma gets another job before Tortorella does. Only because I think Tortorella's last stop was such an abject failure.
Yeah.
But there is going to be a market for him.
He'll get back in. Don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. There's going to be somebody out there who you know, either correctly or foolhardily believes that they need a personality transplant that only John Tortorella can perform, and he'll find a new place.
I never got the sense that John liked being on television in that analyst capacity when he was working with TSN.
I think much like a lot of players and people that you expect to thrive in that setting and then aren't interesting, I think he was one of them. And by that, I mean Jeremy Roenick is the name I was thinking of. I mean, come on, honestly.
Oh, wow.
One time he calls out Patrick Marleau. What are we going to do? Kiss his feet for the rest of his life? He's not exactly the most and again, that's based on expectation. We all expected him to be our Barkley, and he's not our Barkley. He's kind of a bug-eyed dude who occasionally gets into predetermined fights with Mike Milbury. I wish he was better.
A stage fight? How dare you? Okay, so then you're going to say this, and here's what I'm going to come back at you with. And then Liam's going to say, when we return, and then Mike's going to say, no, we're not going to break, damn it.
Right, yeah. And then,
okay,
and
guys,
tomorrow,
okay. It's half an hour before showtime. Let's practice our ad-libs.
Yeah. And then tomorrow, if people watch the clip on Twitter enough, we'll prefabricate a follow-up fight, because that's what we do on this show. So join us tomorrow for, again, more of our conversation about Canadian markets.
That was really good. I'll send you some ideas of what I want to send at you tomorrow. Then you fire back and we'll put together. We'll get Maddie to put together a loose script. So just make sure you don't step on any of my points. Welcome to media and sports.
I'm trying to think of things that rhyme with beaver, but I can't at this point in the show.
Cleaver.
Oh, God.
June Cleaver.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this explosive edition of MVSW. Thanks to Barry Trotz for bringing a calm serenity to the program before things blew up.
And a paper airplane story.
Yeah.
I defy you to go and find any other podcast today that mentions Vitaly Yachmanev and a paper airplane story in Arkansas. Boom. Ain't going to happen.
Yep.
Ain't going to happen. You can look all over iTunes. everywhere. Go on, scroll through all your categories. No other podcast will have Vitaly Yachmanev and a program in Arkansas on Paper Airplane Night on it. Guaranteed.
Get high like planes. It's very exciting, ladies and gentlemen, to have all these people on the show. Thanks, everybody, to Going Postal. Now, are you around tomorrow or no?
I am out. I've got the Habs opener tomorrow, so it's Montreal Boston. So I'm at SNET all day tomorrow.
That's really exciting. I'll be here. Maddie, let's do one tomorrow. We'll get some folks to talk to. And then we'll be all back on the stick on Friday for, yeah. I mean, you have to be here on Friday. It's Game Show Friday.
Oh, I can't wait. I know. I don't know how I'm going to be able to sleep.
The last one we did was really good, though, if memory serves, wasn't it?
It was really good. It was surprisingly good. Now, it's not going to be as good as Littlest Hobo Friday. yeah.
Counting down the weeks. To Littlest Hobo Game Show Friday.
Dude. She's got a blog about it. Not only is she prepping, but she's blogging about Hobo, too. I'm starting to get intimidated.
When the Littlest Hobo tries to travel from city to city, he's jumping on blank. Is it cars? Is it a magic broom? Is it trains? Is it a bigger dog?
Yeah. Is it according to Greg Wyshynski's version of the opening song, which he freestyled on this podcast some 12 months ago. What did the Littlest Hobo jump on? What was he eating out of?
According to the episode 14 of the Littlest Hobo, what did he try to help the little crippled boy throw? Was it A, a football, B, a frisbee, C, his sister, or D, a smaller dog?
And which Wayne's World actor made a cameo and said, in said episode? And which the bonus for that one would be which pro wrestler... Which pro wrestler appeared in that one?
I don't even know the answer to that.
Whipper Billy Watson, former Canadian champion. And the scene was all shot at Kew Gardens in the beaches where I used to live. Oh,
is it
true.
A, Kamala the Ugandan Headhunter, B, Georgie Animal Steel, C, Whipper Billy Washington, was that his name?
Watson, jeez.
Or man. D, the man who will shock the world, the Shockmaster.
That's good. I know you just got to get Shockmaster as much as you can. I always wanted to be there when whomever it was, and maybe it was Jim Harris who played Kamala himself, came up with the idea of putting the Lucky Charms all over his body. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna put a moon and. Was it like eating breakfast one day, like looking for? He's thinking about a look for himself, like. Oh, yeah. I always Lucky Charms shapes all over myself.
One of the things I remember most about Kamala, the Ugandan headhunter, was when LJN used to make the wrestling figures and they made them out of rubber. Remember those big rubber wrestling figures?
Yeah, of course.
They had the Kamala one, I think they may have melted down a monster truck's tires to make. That's how much rubber they used. The thing was, it was like carrying a barbell around. They used so much rubber to make them that big. God, I love those figures. Real quick, did I tell you about this? So,
what's up?
I had all of them, like all of those wrestling figures. I had for a really long time, and my dad, God love him, tried to protect them. Tried to protect them from getting the paint scuffed off when I was playing them, trying to kind of, you know, keep them looking fresh and sharp. So he sprayed them with some kind of a sealant that was supposed to keep the paint on the figures.
Yeah.
And what the sealant did instead was attract all of the dirt. I mean, air, dirt on the ground. So now, instead of having these big rubber wrestling figures with perfect paint jobs and pristine out of the box look, they were just caked in layers of dust and filth to the point where you could take your fingernail and draw your name on the back of them.
So just turn into Pigpen from the Charlie Brown cartoons. Essentially.
Yeah. And needless to say, I believe that they decreased exponentially in value after his experiment to keep them pristine looking.
But they But they met their rightful destiny as topic fodder on the Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. That's why he did it.
That's right. Brandon Moore, can you guys recruit someone involved in the Littlest Hobo to ask the question and Merrick can go head to head? Whoa.
That is pretty tempting. Although, as much as I love the show, I probably couldn't go trivia question for trivia question with it. I'd have to get another vasectomy. I have to get a reverse vasectomy. I'm going to watch all
but
the episodes.
But also, Brendan Moore, I've got bad news for you. We tragically lost Stanley Kubrick many years ago, and of course, he is the creator of Littlest Hobo. I don't know if you knew that.
He wrote shit up.
30% of the episodes and directed the pilot. They let him go when he's like, we should put the Littlest Hobo in a goat's mask and have an elevator open filled with blood.
And have a threesome
like
with
Stanley.
Tom Cruise. Oh, no. Really?
Littlest Hobo barks underneath and subtitles Fidelio. Until he gets into the orgy.
All right.
All right. The Littlest Hobo finds a monolith in the middle of a Toronto park. Stanley Kubrick's the Littlest Hobo.
That's right. Lifts up its leg
though.
And has a squirt on monolith in the middle of Kew Gardens, middle of Hyde Park. 2001.
The Littlest Hobo's eyelids are kept open, and he's forced to watch violence against dogs around the world.
That's right.
The sound effects.
Watch German Shepherds attacking.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my Dvotchkas. Oh, my Dvotchkas.
Oh, and he keeps on typing over and over again. All work and no play makes the Littlest Hobo a dull dog.
Makes Hobo a dull dog. That's right.
Makes Hobo a dull dog.
All right.
Here's Hobo.
Your life is... Okay, I'm going now. I gotta go pick up my kids.
All right, everybody.
JK,
bye.
Get lost. Bye.
Okay, bye.